Want to feel more confident with your finances this year? If you have 60 seconds, I can show you how quick and easy it is to start building healthy money habits that could last you the entire year just by using Rocket Money. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link all your accounts and see your entire spending picture, your subscriptions, your upcoming bills, your due dates, everything. Step three, tap a subscription you don't use and cancel it. Boom! That's money back every single month. Step four, create a financial goal for something you want to save for, whether it be a vacation, a retirement account, or a pet's birthday. We don't judge. Now let the app automatically move small amounts of cash towards your goal. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you saved. Similar to the over 10 million members on the app that have saved up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Use the savings challenge as one step closer to feeling better about your finances today at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. One more time, it's rocketmoney.com/cancel.
At Lowe's, get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, install, and more when you spend $2,500 on select major appliances. Lowe's, we help you save. Valid through 225 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, Florida. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Visit Lowe's.com/terms for details. Subject to change.
Visit your nearby Lowe's on Silver Drive in Columbus.
From NBI Studios, this is Truth and Justice, a crowdsourced investigation in real time. I'm Bob Ruff.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to an episode of Truth and Justice I'm super excited about, been looking forward to for a long time. I'm glad we finally have been able to work it out. And I have one big shout out to Michael Osbrook, who made the connection, so we were able to make this happen. But I'm joined today by super attorney and YouTube content creator, Andrea Burkhart. Andrea, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Bob. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm real excited. We talked a little bit off air before we started, and I kind of want to do this in two phases. So this may end up as two weekly episodes on the audio. Our patrons who are watching live are going to get it all right now. But we're going to be talking about Delphi today. And during the Delphi trial, Bob Mata was our primary source of information. You know, Bob was there in the trial taking notes, and we had him on several times breaking down not only the trial, but some of the stuff that came out after the trial. But Andrea was also there in the courtroom. We talked quite a bit about your streams that you were doing after the fact, same as Bob was doing. So we have not only another person that was in the room at the trial, but another attorney who was in the room at the trial that has your own unique perspective on how things went. So real quick, I don't want to make you spend forever going over your CV, but most people know who you are. But if you could just kind of give us a quick little background on who you are and what you do before we get into the Delphi stuff.
Sure. Well, so I'm an attorney over in Washington State. I've practiced for just about 20 years now, and the majority of my career has been in criminal defense, primarily public defense at both a trial level and then for about the last 8 years or so, exclusively at the appellate level. So I have pretty much handled every aspect of a criminal case that you can You can expect to see pretty much every case type, every type of defendant, really seen it all. And so then I went to Delphi and realized there's always something new that you wouldn't expect, and just kind of have to now kind of reincorporate into your worldview about how the criminal justice system works and the fairness of the process and all of those types of things.
Yeah, it's such a wild case because So many times when there is, especially not, I mean, now in 2025, 2026, in, last year when the trial was going on, with as educated as people are because of like podcasts and YouTube channels like yours and stuff, people are a lot more aware of wrongful convictions, that when something, when a questionable conviction happens, usually there's a huge uprising and everyone's rallying the troops. This is one of those cases where, to me, when I take in all the information, I am extremely uncomfortable with the conviction. It seems very obvious that we should be very uncomfortable with the conviction. Mm-hmm. But most people outside of the true crime space are just without question 100% convinced that Richard Allen is guilty. And then within the true crime space, there's like this hard divide. There's a hard divide of people that are dead set that he's obviously guilty, and the group of people that are convinced that he's innocent. You just don't find a lot of people that are in the middle, which is a little strange. You know, usually it seems like it sways one way or the other, or people are unsure, which is why that I'm so excited to have you here. And then also, real quick, where can people find you on YouTube when you're talking about this and other cases?
YouTube, you could just find me under my name, Andrea Burkhart. My handle is A Burkhart Law. That's my handle on a whole bunch of different platforms. So anywhere you like to look for people running their mouth, that's the right. handle to use, and see if you can find me. Yeah.
Now, are you still practicing? Because like that was like going to Delphi, that was a huge chunk of your time to go all the way from Washington State and spend all that time there.
It was. So I have been kind of ratcheting down my practice for the last really couple of years. It's a little bit of a work in progress, being able to get rid of your caseload. But when Delphi came up, I was at a point where, you know, I deadlines were pretty few and far between and pretty easy to manage and stuff like that. So I was able to spend the 6 weeks there that it took in Delphi. Long days going into the night, having to, the first 2 weeks we had to sleep out on the courthouse steps to be able to get our access into the courtroom. We had 22 public seats, I think was the total count. And obviously quite a bit more interest than that. So lines mm-hmm. started forming quite early. I was lucky enough that after about 2 weeks, I had some folks just on their own decide they wanted to coordinate having line sitters for me. So just took that upon themselves, found volunteers who were willing to come out and take shifts to sit in the line overnight so that I would be able to get some sleep and then be conscious to take notes the next day and report them back. So I remain eternally grateful to the Delphi line sitters because none of this would have happened without them.
That's such a cool thing with the true crime community because that, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that what people realize that this is a trial in a case that everyone's been so invested in for so long, getting justice for Abby and Libby. And then the trial's happening. And then none of us had any way to know what was happening there unless people we trust, like you and Bob, were there to be able to report back to us. So I think it's awesome that there are, you know, people that had the ability to go wait in line and go in themselves were like, no, I'd rather hold that spot in line and let Andrea go in and then share everything with the world. So that's all. I actually didn't know that. That's really cool.
It was amazing. It was so generous and just a great spirit of collaboration that people brought. That's exactly the reason I went to Delphi is because I was very interested in the case, but had a very hard time following it in the pretrial stage mm-hmm. because it was so opaque. It was very difficult to get a hold of the legal documents. As it turns out, a whole bunch of the legal documents were being kept off the docket in the first place. So it was just, it's difficult as a legal analyst to be able to give opinions if I don't have the source information to be able to rely on. And so I knew that was going to be an issue with this trial to be able to make sense out of what was happening and have an opinion about is this fair? Is this right? Are they doing it correctly? Is it going to stand up to appeal? And just all those things that people want to know when they watch a trial. I wasn't going to be able to have an opinion like that unless I had a solid source of information. And without the cameras, without having an audio feed, without having some kind of transcript or other direct source, I knew I had to be there in the courtroom. And so I appreciated so much that other people shared that value and pitched in the way that they did, put their own lives aside. It's to this day, it remains just this incredible story that I am so honored to be a part of.
Yeah. And it was so because a lot of, you know, other like myself, you know, not only true crime content creators, but also that work primarily in wrongful convictions. It's me and lots of other people. Everyone's was coming to us for opinions on it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like you, like, I can't. And if you listen to the coverage I did on it, I'm like, I wasn't there. Mm-hmm. I can't make assumptions based on what the news is saying and this person's saying. So I was just relying on, you know, you guys that were there to share. At least so we got some glimpse of what was happening in the courtroom. So I guess let's kind of move into that. I'll let you take it kind of whatever angle you want to. But I'm really interested in your your take on the trial, because obviously you're still involved with it now. So mm-hmm. I'm sure you feel like the conviction wasn't, you weren't comfortable with it either. So if you can kind of walk through what parts of the trial really, really made you feel the way you did. I guess, what is your position on the case and what was it about the trial that led you to that position?
So my position is that based on the state's evidence, I certainly don't think the conviction is warranted. And I personally am not at all confident that Richard Allen is guilty or even had anything to do with this crime at all. There's just such a nominal amount of evidence. And the evidence that there is generally of quite low quality that tends to connect him with the crime. And then when you compare that with what the jury didn't see, with the issues that were litigated pre-trial and have since come out in the appeal as part of the basis for reversing the conviction, just other suspicions and angles that seem to be, frankly, at least as strong, if not considerably stronger than the suspicions that were ever able to be corroborated with respect to Richard Allen. The pretrial process itself, of course, is extremely troubling from a constitutional standpoint. This man who has no prior convictions of any kind was scooped up, arrested and transported to maximum security prison where he was held in solitary confinement. So basically in the worst of the worst possible detention context for 13 months. And a man who's supposed to be presumed innocent in a context that is pretty much the antithesis of any of that. So just, I have serious liberty concerns about the process as a whole, but also just the way that contributed to the case because of the effect that it had on Richard Allen's mental state, on his behavior, culminating in what are now pretty much the strongest pieces of evidence, in my view, that the state had against him, which were the quote-unquote confessions. I always put them in kind of irony quotes because I heard them. I was in court. I heard the recordings. I heard the notes. I saw kind of what the content of these were and the tone in which they were conveyed and so forth. And there was a defense expert, can't remember his name now off the top of my head, but he was specifically a psychiatrist who has an expertise in false confessions and described a lot of the characteristics that you would see. And so you could listen to these confessions and just hear all of those elements playing out, things like uncertainty about what's being said. I think I did it. Maybe I did do it. A confession that isn't particularly emotional. He described how when you're describing a true memory, what you're really remembering is your feelings at the time. And so that will come through in how an event is described. Whereas some stories are a little bit more explanatory. They're more logical. They're more focused on things like, oh, there was a shell casing that needs to be accounted for. And so that's incorporated into my story.
I'm interrupting this ad break to tell you how you can never have to hear another ad and take a huge step towards helping us continue our work all at the same time. As most of you know, I provide all investigative and advocacy services to the people and attorneys that we cover on the show completely free. Over the years, we provided hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of professional investigations to the wrongfully convicted, completely free of charge. And the reason that we're able to do that is in large part thanks to the support of listeners like you. Our Patreon community funds the overwhelming majority of our work. And I want to take this opportunity to ask and encourage you to join the club. The base level membership is just $5 a month. Now, while that's only a cup of coffee's worth out of your account, it makes all the difference in the world to us and the people that we work with. And for your $5 a month, you get a whole list of extra content, exclusive just for patrons. Every week, Janet, Zach, and I do an hour-long live stream just for our patrons. You also get an unedited video version of the Friday follow-up every week, a weekly pregame podcast that drops into your podcast feed. Patrons often get to participate in interviews that we do on the show live days or weeks before the rest of the audience gets to hear them. And of course, the best part, all of our content is completely ad-free for our patrons at the $5 a month level. Patreon really is the only way that we're able to keep doing this work. And it would mean the absolute world to me, Zach, Janet, and Erica if you'd consider joining if you're able to do so. Joining the Patreon community is super easy. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. Or you can go right to the episode description of this or any episode and just click the link. Thank you from the bottom of our hearts for your support. And now I'll return you to your regularly scheduled ads.
The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals. Whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation, Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Are you a fraud-paying American? It's a fact that one in four honest, hardworking, tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity theft. With LifeLock Identity Theft Protection, though, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, and get you your money back. Last year, the IRS flagged over $16 billion in refunds for identity fraud. That's billions of dollars that could come from your salary, overtime, or second job. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. LifeLock monitors millions of data points per second for your personal information and alerts you to threats you could easily miss on your own. And if your information does fall into the wrong hands, only LifeLock has U.S.-based restoration specialists who are backed by the Million Dollar Protection Package. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart and save up to 40% your first year. That's 40% off at LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Moto Casino. America's social casino.
So just many points in this case where procedurally there were a lot of calls that, in my view, really call into question the fairness of how he was treated and whether he was really going to be given a fair shake at defending himself. And even with the multiple advantages that the state had because of that kind of tilted process, the inability still to be able to generate significant corroboration of the theory that Richard Allen was the perpetrator is what left me with the conclusion that I don't think this is it. I don't think he's the one that did it.
Yeah, I looked at it from kind of two angles. One was just constitutionally speaking, fair trial. Mm-hmm. That seems very obvious that he was not given a fair trial, the pretrial conditions, as you mentioned. But then there's like the idea of the factual innocence. And this is where and we have some folks that are some of my listeners that are convinced that he's guilty. Mm-hmm. I think most probably lean the other way, probably both lean too strong either way, because with the limited information we have. But, looking at it from if he's innocent until proven guilty, I just try to take every case and look at, did they prove to me that to make me believe without a reasonable doubt he's guilty? And I don't see, add to this if I'm wrong or if I'm missing something, but it seems to me like the stanchions of the state's case were the ballistics on the spent shell, mm-hmm. which were questionable, extremely questionable at best. Of course, the fact that he puts himself there around the time of the murders. Mm-hmm. But then the main, and none of those would have meant anything to me without the confessions. And I also always put them in air quotes because, you know, we've spent many, many hours over the years talking to, we've had Jim Trainum on and Jim Clemente on and Tim Clemente. And we've had, Jim Fitzgerald. We've had everybody that does these, kind of guiding and teaching us over the years what we're looking for in a real confession. It just wasn't there for me. Like you said, there was, he starts off by, I did it. Well, I think I did it. Maybe I did it. What if I did it? Mm-hmm. And for those, and this is something that Jim Trainum, who I think is probably by most considered one of the world's leading experts in false confessions, he always said, that's not a confession. Mm-hmm. A confession is a story. A confession has a beginning, middle, and end. It has a narrative and it can be corroborated by evidence. Mm-hmm. I think I did it is not a confession. Mm-hmm. What do you mean you think you did it? Or what do you mean you did it? And then when he finally gets into giving a narrative, there's no emotion to it. It's just piecemealing pieces together. And then we take into a fact, the mental state that he was in. Mm-hmm. I just can't, and I have no, and I'm somebody that it was just really right down. I have no bias in this case. Mm-hmm. I'm not a part of it. It's not a case I was covering. So it's not like I need this guy to be innocent. Mm-hmm. I'm just like, this isn't a confession. It's not convincing me that he did it. There's reasonable doubt all over this. And I don't see. And then once the trial was over and I started seeing, which we'll get into in a little bit, but for me, and I have no idea, and I'm curious your thoughts on that, because I have no idea really what's come about in the last year in the case. Mm-hmm. But right afterwards, when I saw the FBI's search warrant for Ron Logan and was looking mm-hmm. at all the evidence that they had against him, and I'm like, if I was holding these two next to each other, I'm not saying Ron Logan did it, but if I was holding those two next to each other, mm-hmm. that sure as hell a lot better suspect than Richard Allen was.
Sure.
And it just didn't convince me. Did I miss anything as far as, because I feel like I remember there was just those really big three points as far as their case against him.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's pretty much it. And there's so much once you start digging in. I mean, a whole other issue with the confessions in irony quotes that we haven't talked about is simply their provenance, because few of them are actually, in Richard Allen's own words, verifiable things that we can hear for ourselves. And the one that is the most incriminating, this detailed confession, is not that. We only have this detailed account delivered to us secondhand from his prison psychologist, Dr. Monica Walla. And Dr. Walla is a big problem in and of herself in terms of the provenance. It came out at trial that she was herself a true crime devotee. She was, in fact, closely following this case. She was, participating in forum conversations about it. She was discussing what was going on online and kind of in the media with Richard Allen while she's treating him. She took a personal visit to the bridge so that she could attend the scene. So these behaviors on her part that are just very concerning from a standpoint of professionalism, but there's also a level of involvement in the kind of forensic side of kind of dealing with Richard Allen in his mental condition that is extremely inappropriate for a clinical psychologist to be engaging in. These are roles that have very strict and distinct divisions between them in the criminal justice system. You do not get forensic evaluations from the person that is providing you with your treatment and vice versa. So for Monica Walla to be the person that Richard Allen is kind of dependent on for his sanity, she's one of the few human contacts that he has throughout a lot of this early process of being incarcerated in Westville in the maximum security wing. But she's also supposed to be, this is supposed to be a trusted position, a position of confidence, somebody that you can share your deepest, darkest secrets with, and that's supposed to be protected. And so to see that get distorted the way that it was, that her focus was not on Richard Allen's well-being, but on this, I mean, it just read like attempting to elicit information and to play this kind of forensic investigative role in the case, was just extremely, extremely troubling to me. It represented a very improper blurring of boundaries that should not take place.
Were there motions filed to try to suppress her from testifying? I mean, because I don't know, I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know the law, but it seems to me that everything you're saying, I would think would disqualify, in most trials that, you know, that I read for my case would, you know, there's often situations, I mean, not quite this bad, but similar to this, where, you know, a judge will rule like, no, this person can't testify this because of all these reasons. Was that attempted?
You know, I don't believe that it was specifically. And part of the reason why I got a big lesson in admissibility of particularly opinion evidence in Indiana when I went to this trial.
Mm-hmm.
Indiana has this peculiar standard that is unlike anything I have seen anywhere else. I've looked at trials in many states and in the federal system and so forth. I've never seen a rule like this where they allow what they call learned witnesses. And so a learned witness is somebody who is kind of in between a lay person and but doesn't qualify to be an expert. And what it essentially boils down to is normally a lay person, you don't get to offer your opinions. You are just there to testify to your percipient observations. What do you know personally from what you saw, from what you heard, and so forth. To give an opinion in court, you have to have some type of expert qualification. And that typically means that you have the kind of training and experience or education that gives you knowledge that's, you know, far above and beyond what the ordinary layperson is going to have. A learned witness in Indiana is just a layperson that they really want to be able to give an opinion, but wouldn't otherwise qualify to do it. It's defined as just basically like you're in a special position for whatever reason to be able to offer an opinion. And so there was an amount of information that came in under this rule that was just shocking to me. For example, the prison guards who were there to kind of supervise Richard Allen, take notes of what he was doing and what he was saying and you know, check in on his safety and give him his food and all that stuff. These prison guards were allowed to testify to their opinions about whether he was faking mental illness. They are not psychologists. They probably don't even have a lot of college. Like, they don't have the type of background that in any other court in the country I've ever seen you would have to have in order to offer an opinion like this. But that was allowed in Indiana under this learned witness rule. And so with Dr. Walla, I think the real fight had happened just in the process of getting her records at all, because the state did try to get her records a couple of times, and that was denied because they are privileged. These are classic therapist-patient records, even if she is, you know, an employee of the prison and he's a prisoner there. But what ultimately happened, I think it was about the third time the state tried, the judge decided, well, the defense has put it in issue because they had challenged the safekeeping order that put him in solitary confinement in the first place. His defense lawyers were trying to get him removed from prison and put back into a county jail. And they were arguing because his condition is deteriorating so badly, this is one of the reasons he would need to be moved. And so Judge Gohl concluded, well, he's putting his whole mental state at issue because of that. Therefore, go ahead and have all of his mental health records. And so once that decision was made, it's pretty much the cat is out of the bag at that point. The records are coming in one way or another, whether Dr. Walla testifies or not. It is not necessarily going to move the needle in terms of the information that's coming in. And just from a strategic standpoint, it probably made more sense at that point for the defense to have her come in so that they could bring up all of these professionalism problems and the, you know, the fascination with the case and things like that that tended to undermine her credibility.
The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit. Track budgets and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps. In line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free to play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Every year, people make the same fitness goal, train harder. But most fail because recovery gets ignored, especially connective tissue that muscles depend on to grow. Frog Fuel was developed by Navy SEALs and perfected by a Stanford-trained scientist, delivering 15 grams of nano-hydrolyzed collagen protein that digests in just 15 minutes. It's science-backed and ready to drink. No mixing, no sugar, no junk. This year, don't just train harder, recover smarter. Go to frogfuel.com. That's frogfuel.com. Stay unbreakable.
It is Ryan Seacrest here. There was a recent social media trend which consisted of flying on a plane with no music, no movies, no entertainment. But a better trend would be going to ChumbaCasino.com. It's like having a mini social casino in your pocket. Chumba Casino has over 100 online casino-style games, all absolutely free. It's the most fun you can have online and on a plane. So grab your free welcome bonus now at ChumbaCasino.com. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Yeah, that whole learned witness thing is like I've never seen anything like. And I'm actually working on a case in Indiana right now, and that state has so many. Which I live a minute and a half from Indiana. I'm right on the Michigan-Indiana border, and it's just shocking to me how much like that's a crazy rule.
It is.
And then, you know, like I'm dealing with, and I just had Susan Simpson on last week, and she was dealing with one of her cases, like getting open records in Indiana is like impossible. For the case I'm working on, the Chris Bynum case, I mean, the defendant's attorneys cannot get the police files. Like they have all these exclusionary rules. And some of the things like the, you know, this whole like learned witness thing, like is there a crossover with federal Supreme Court rules, constitutional rules, like it, that seems like they're allowing something that makes a trial unfair. I'm not a constitutional expert, so I don't know where, but it seems like there should be a problem there. Is there not?
There's really not from a constitutional standpoint. You have you have a broad protection for due process purposes, but that just tends to be regarded as a kind of procedural baselines. There are no real substantive rights that are protected under the Constitution that really apply in this context. There's a quite famous speech that was given, or I think it was a dissent in an opinion by Justice Scalia several years back, where he was not a fan of substantive due process and this idea of having rights to things like, you know, fairness and not having pseudoscience infect your trial and stuff like that. And so Scalia's position was that it doesn't offend the Constitution to execute a factually innocent person so long as they've been provided all of the procedural fairness that they're entitled to under, you know, the constitutional floor in terms of the jury trial and right to testify and so forth. But otherwise, it's really, there's a lot of flexibility on the parts of courts to shape their evidentiary rules and requirements the way that they want. One of the issues that came up in this particular case with the ballistics, and just, you know, we barely touched on that, how the process here was that the analyst compared a spent shell casing that she fired from Richard Allen's gun to an unfired cartridge that was found at the scene. So these materials have gone through different processes for purposes of comparison. Quite a bad process, but ultimately concluded, yeah, this is Richard Allen's gun that produced the marks on this unfired cartridge. There was a case within the last couple of years out of Maryland, State versus Abruqua, where the Maryland Supreme Court took on this pseudoscience in ballistics that's been kind of this has been a simmering issue all around the country for many, many years. It's one I litigated, back in like 2017 or so, almost 10 years ago now, in one of my last trials. And the problem with so many of these forensic disciplines is that they just aren't particularly well validated. There's not a good foundation to be able to establish that the assumptions that they're based on are true. And so with things like forensics, there's forensic ballistics, there's this idea that, well, if the marks are close enough, then we can conclude that no other firearm could have produced them. But we don't really actually know that. We don't know to what degree are the similarities statistically significant or not. So Maryland has thrown out this type of evidence in their courts. You are not allowed to testify that marks on a shell casing mean that it came from a particular gun. That's not a scientific conclusion that can be drawn. They can only testify that it's consistent with that firearm. So that to me is like, that should be the rule everywhere, frankly. I mean, science, if you're going to put something in front of a jury and purport for it to be science, it should follow minimum scientific principles. But courts vary widely on that. I mean, I think to this point, it's Maryland and Oregon that follow that particular rule. No other court has followed it yet. So some courts you can use pseudoscience, others you can't.
And it feels like so many of the laws and how they, you know, what's allowed and what's not, really doesn't consider the practicality and reality of how a layman juror is going to interpret what's being said by the expert. You know, even in Maryland or Oregon, where they have these rules, if an expert comes in and says it's consistent with this, that's certainly not saying it came from that gun. But I think for most people that just, you know, in Richard Allen's case, it was, you know, I think the jury is like, oh, so it's his gun then. You're not saying it, but you're saying it. It's his gun. It's just so dangerous. And like you said, in this case, that was, I'm certainly no ballistics expert. But when I read through all the and listened to everybody's coverage of how this was done, like even as a layman, I was like, well, if you ejected a shell the same way that one was ejected and it didn't match, and you had to fire it, and there was like 10 tries, and it, you know, it took so many before they found one that could be consistent with it. To present that in front of a jury as some kind of evidence that it came from that gun is insane.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's so clearly engineered, you know, it's the evidence didn't fit. And so you had to distort it to try to get it to fit. And unfortunately, that was characteristic of, I think, so much of the state's case between the confessions, and the sketches and the timeline, for example. One of the reasons why Richard Allen, you know, put himself at the scene at the time when Richard Allen was interviewed and recorded, so that we're able to see and verify for ourselves. He puts himself at the scene quite a bit earlier than the murders took place. He puts himself at the scene in more of the, like, you know, 11:30, 12 to 1:30 kind of time frame, and less the later time frame. Towards 1:30, 2 o'clock. And so he described running into four girls that he saw on the trail. He gave description, long dark hair and different characteristics and so forth. Well, so then the state, in the process of trying to connect Richard Allen with their timeline, has three girls on the trail, don't really match the descriptions of the individuals that Richard Allen has described. But they just conclude these have to be the same people. They must be the same people. And so therefore, you know, he puts himself on the bridge at the right time. Another example of this is the person that the witnesses saw in the first place. Betsy Blair is probably the most pertinent one in terms of who she saw, because she saw the girls. She saw Abby and Libby, as well as seeing who she is, who they are attributing to being Bridge Guy. Her sketch, of course, looks nothing like Richard Allen. And then Sarah Carbaugh, who was driving down the road that's kind of next to the trail system there, sees the muddy, bloody man on the road a couple hours later, about, I think it was 3:30 or 4:30 in the afternoon. And so she produces a sketch. They don't look anything alike. They're clearly not the same person. And yet under the state's theory, they have to be the same person. And so what do? They oppose the sketches being presented into the evidence so that the jury wouldn't see how much they are having to try to twist and distort and push the facts in order to manufacture a reason to think that Richard Allen was guilty.
Yeah, it's very clearly easy to see the difference between an evidence-driven investigation and a suspect-driven investigation. Mm-hmm. Because everything, you know, they're not gathering and analyzing evidence and seeing where it leads them. They're starting with their conclusion and then trying to bend the evidence to make it fit. And frankly, I don't think they did a very good job of that.
No, and I think an important thing, too, is that they stop asking questions when they've gone far enough. And that the kind of hallmark of that, the pinnacle of that, was at trial when they have these witnesses from the trail on the stand and don't ask a single one of them. This guy sitting right here at the defense table in front of you, is that the man that you saw on the bridge? Like, the right. In-court identification is just a fundamental classic part of the trial process. We didn't get it here. And so you have to kind of wonder, why would the state not do that? But then another piece of it, too, was all of the DNA. There was a massive amount of DNA that was recovered in this case from the clothing, from the bodies, from the scene, and very little of it was subject to testing. And so the explanation for that was that, well, many, if not most, of these samples were degraded. Many, if not most, of these samples weren't suitable for the classic STR type DNA comparison. That's sort of the default that you use in criminal cases. But DNA technology has come an enormous distance in the last 5 years or so. And so there are now all kinds of whole genome sequencing processes, next gen processes that are available and particularly useful with partial profiles or limited information, small samples or things like that. But none of these methods were ever pursued. They stopped asking, you know, the question on what is potentially some of the most probative evidence that there is. And the explanation that the state gave for that was just so mind-boggling to me, because I've never heard prosecutors make excuses for the presence of DNA. Oh, it's just secondary transfer. Oh, she lived with men, and so they do their laundry together, and so you would expect male DNA to be on the laundry. These are explanations that defense lawyers give when their DNA shows up in a place that is not very helpful to a position of innocence. So to hear that coming from a prosecutor as a justification for why they didn't want to ask any more questions, to me showed, oh, you have a defensive mindset towards your own case. You need to defend it. You don't need to aggressively pursue it. The thing about good, solid cases that really establish somebody's guilt is that they corroborate the theory on so many different levels. You will have the confession. You will have, I mean, ideally, obviously, you don't always get that, but you will have something. You will have DNA. You will have location data. You will have writings. You will have internet searches. You will have phone conversations. You will have a history of this type of behavior. You will have eyewitnesses. You will be able to track the trail. You'll have contacts, prior communications, some kind of network connection with the victims in the case. You'll have some kind of motive. And so all of these things correspond. And it ends up a lot of times as a defense attorney, you're kind of racing to get to trial, because the more the prosecutor gets to dig, you know, the more that they're going to find and the harder it's going to be to be able to counter it. And so this was the polar opposite of that case. They could not stop digging fast enough once they got that ballistics match and then were kind of gifted those confessions as a result of the pretrial confinement. That was it. They were done looking further to corroborate his involvement at that point. And to me, that is just so incredibly telling and suspicious, and a reason to be skeptical of the theory.
Yeah, I agree 100%. The last question I want to ask you as on the trial is, you mentioned all the weird rules and things from Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
Have you thought about, how do you think this trial may have gone differently if it were in, say, your home state of Washington?
Depends on the judge, honestly. you know, the judge has an enormous influence over how the trial goes, what comes in, what doesn't come in, what arguments you get to make, what you don't. What we saw consistently with Judge Gull was just bending over backwards for the benefit of the prosecution and handcuffing the defense without oftentimes any good legal reason that I was able to ascertain. The reality is you have judges like that all over. Maybe not quite as hostile as Judge Gull was, but you have judges all over the country that will give every benefit of the doubt to the prosecution, will be skeptical of everything that the defense wants to do, look for reasons to block the defense from being able to pursue their strategy. So I would love to say that, it would just be a different case. Our rules would be somewhat different. We wouldn't have a bunch of prison guards up here testifying that Richard Allen was malingering psychosis. You know, that's not going to happen. We might have had a little bit more of a side eye at the ballistics. We probably would have allowed the defense's second expert, PhD metallurgist, who was there to testify about the testing that was actually done, as well as to criticize the standards, the methodology that's used in that case, to explain the lack of scientific vigor behind the conclusions. That's generally going to be allowed in Washington. Maybe you could get into a different situation with the voluntariness of the confessions. That if you had the right judge, I think that's a winning argument you can make, but it would be pretty individual. So I don't want to blame too much on Indiana and its weird rules, although some of them are very weird. The learned witness thing is weird. Like I can't get behind that really, no matter what. But I think that the biggest factor by far in this was Judge Gull and simply her attitude towards the case, her extreme hostility to the defense, and her willingness to find ways to give the prosecution essentially whatever they asked for.
All right. Well, I think that is a great place for us to end for this week. That takes us all the way through the trial, and it's another unique look for another attorney that was in the room. So I want to thank Andrea for that. And then we're going to be back again with Andrea next week to talk about what's been going on since the conviction and the post-trial work. And we'll be doing all that next week. Truth and Justice is an NBI Studios production, co-written and produced by Erica Bergenham. Music created and composed by Caden Ladislaw. Follow-up episodes are co-hosted by Janet Varney and Zach Weaver. Our logo font was created by Tate Krupa of Red Swan Graphic Design. Our website is created, managed, and maintained by Katie Ross of createdintandem.com. Thank you to our volunteer transcription team, Erica Cantor, Kathy McElhaney, Courtney Wimberly, Kate Wood Yomnick, Danielle Rohr, Jennifer Athey, and Caroline Dwyer. Truth and Justice provides all investigative and advocacy work for the wrongfully convicted completely free of charge. We're able to do that in large part thanks to you, our listeners, through your generous pledges on Patreon. Patreon accounts for the overwhelming majority of our funding. The number one way you can support our work is to become a patron at patreon.com/truthandjustice. For just $5 a month, you'll get all episodes ad-free, a bonus pregame episode every Wednesday, and also a video version of the Friday follow-ups exclusive to our patrons. Patrons also get to participate and join the chat live in many of our interviews and get early access to much of our content. Just go to patreon.com/truthandjustice to sign up. You can also help us out by going to iTunes and leaving us a 5-star rating and review. It doesn't cost you a penny and goes a long way towards making the show more visible. If you have a new case that you'd like us to consider, you can submit your cases on our website, truthandjusticepod.com. Just click on the case submission button and fill out the form. You can always keep in touch with us through our email at theories@truthandjusticepod.com. You can like our Facebook page or join in on the conversation on the official Truth and Justice Podcast fans page. You can also connect with us on social media platform X @truthjusticepod. And to follow our personal accounts on social media, I can be found at Bob Ruff Truth. Janet can be found at Janet Varney, and Zach is at Z to the Q. However you do it, stay engaged and stay in touch. But as for now, we're signing off. I'm Bob Ruff.
I'm Zach Weaver.
And I'm Janet Varney.
And this has been Truth and Justice.
Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Moto Casino. America's
social casino. Are you a fraud-paying American? One in four tax-paying Americans has been a victim of identity fraud. With LifeLock, if your identity is stolen, they fix it, guaranteed, or your money back. Last year, billions in refunds were stolen. Could be from your salary, overtime, or second job. Gone. But this year, you don't need to stay a victim. Because this tax season, fraud-paying American is something no American should have to claim. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Every year, people make the same fitness goal, train harder. But most fail because recovery gets ignored, especially connective tissue that muscles depend on to grow. Frog Fuel was developed by Navy SEALs and perfected by a Stanford-trained scientist, delivering 15 grams of nano-hydrolyzed collagen protein that digests in just 15 minutes. It's science-backed and ready to drink. No mixing, no sugar, no junk. This year, don't just train harder, recover smarter. Go to frogfuel.com. That's frogfuel.com. Stay unbreakable.